Hey everybody, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the host of Marketplace, your daily download on the economy. Money influences so much of what we do and how we live. That's why it's essential to understand how this economy works. At Marketplace, we break down everything from inflation and student loans to the future of AI so that you can understand what it all means for you. Marketplace is your secret weapon for understanding this economy. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, back from vacation, and I'm here only with our film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello, it's just us two.
Yeah, what happened to everybody? It's summer, I guess it's a...
August, it's hard to get anyone to do anything.
I know, I wish we were in Europe where everyone just like genuinely takes August off and we could all just be sitting on a beach somewhere. But instead we're talking into microphones, talking about movies that you watch indoors.
Yay.
Ideal summer activity. It's kind of an interesting period now because we've got the fall festivals basically right around the corner. But there's kind of an interesting couple of awardsy things happening. And before we get into movies that are actually out right now, and then later on, Richard, we'll have your interview with Carrie Coon, who's Emmy nominated for a different awards focus. The trailer for Darren Aronofsky's Mother broke in the last week. And we don't usually just talk about trailers here, but I think it's so interesting and the movie itself is so interesting that I wanted to get your thoughts on it. It was not what I thought it was going to be. Were you surprised by it?
I was, you know, because it was this project that was sort of shrouded in mystery and people knew it was maybe a horror movie, maybe, you know, kind of thriller, but that was kind of it. And so tonally, we weren't really sure what to expect. And then this trailer came out and showed what looks to be, I don't know, sort of a Rosemary's Baby-esque thing, maybe, where this woman played by Jennifer Lawrence is being... I don't know, used for nefarious things in some kind of family environment. Javier Bardem is her husband, I believe. So yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I think the most interesting thing about the movie right now is its sort of release date shuffle, where it was originally going to come out in October, I believe, right? And then they moved it to some middle of September, right after it screens at Toronto. It's also going to be at the Venice Film Festival earlier. So I don't know what that means in terms of its, you know, quality or prestige factor, but it's sort of arriving in this odd way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to have it coming in September because, I mean, when you read the box office tea leaves, like usually September is kind of a summer holdovers, like a lot of the Resident Evil movies open in September. And every now and then you'll get something that's interesting, like September and October are kind of a time for like the Argos or the arrivals of award season where they have a big audience play. And September, I feel like it's them saying like, we're not in this for the awards. We think the audiences will go for this. So come what may. But I don't think it's worth counting it out for awards just because it's doing this kind of weird shuffle.
No, I think that increasingly release date, it's less of an indicator of prestiginess than it used to be. I mean, it still obviously comes into play to some extent because if you're really trying to mount an awards campaign, you have to kind of think about the tail of the movie and like when once it comes out, I guess, and it gets good reviews. But like how long does it last or linger in sort of people's minds? So that's, I think, why, you know, traditionally movies are coming out in November, December that they want to win Oscars. But yeah, I don't think September is an absolute, you know, no go then. And it's Aronofsky who, you know, last time he made a psychological kind of horror movie, Black Swan, it was a huge sort of surprise box office hit with a low budget, but it also got nominated for a ton of Oscars and won one for Natalie Portman. So, you know, like we shouldn't count him out, even if this is just some small genre exercise, because the last time he did that, it worked out really well.
Yeah, I think it's really cool to say like, oh, I'm just here with this genre exercise and, you know, I'm just going to go for the audiences. But my bet would be that it surprises us in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, the cast is really killer. You've got like Jennifer Lawrence and Darren Aronofsky dating behind the scenes. There's a lot of reason to be intrigued by it beyond even the pretty good trailer.
Yeah. And I think for me and for many people, just judging by the Twitter reaction, this is another sort of... stepping stone on the Michelle Pfeiffer sans or whatever you want to call it,
yeah.
You know, where she's really come roaring back in a way with a lauded but tiny movie at Sundance earlier this year and this and obviously the Bernie Madoff movie on HBO.
Murder on the Orient Express.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so she's doing a lot, and this could be a pretty juicy one, I think. I mean, the movie's called Mother. It's not clear if that refers to Jennifer Lawrence's character, or it could refer to Michelle Pfeiffer's character, who does seem to be in the trailer. Judging by the trailer, she seems to be playing Jennifer Lawrence's maybe evil mother, or I don't know. But but you know, I love her in that kind of role. You know, I think back to her sort of ambivalent, you know, half villain, half not Catwoman, or she was in a great movie, or I think it's great, a weird Mike Nichols movie called Wolf with Jack Nicholson, where she's not a villain in that, but it's a kind of dark, sort of sexy kind of movie. So this could continue in that vein, which we know her to be great at. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I think I'm way more interested and also kind of scared between that and It. I think September is going to be a challenging month for people like you and me who can't really handle horror that well.
Yeah, I had some difficulty with the It trailer, you know.
Yeah.
Mother is sort of more in the, closer to what I can handle horror-wise. But, well, at least judging from the trailer, so I don't know. But yeah, I will go into it trepidatiously, I think.
Yeah, we're going to need to like plan some trips to bars afterwards to calm down after these screenings.
One kind of bit of inside baseball that I think I can say is that I based on the trailer, I emailed a publicist for the film and for Mother, and I was like, oh, any chance you're doing screenings pre-TIFF, just because it's coming out so soon after the after I get back from the festival. And a publicist told me that she hadn't even seen the movie. So,
oh, interesting.
Who knows what that indicates. But, you know, again, it'll be at Venice. And my guess is it'll make something of a splash there. Doesn't it feel like a very sort of movie the Italians will embrace?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Like the home of Dario Argento. It seems made for it.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segeith, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%, based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
So to go back to the actual current movies you can see, or at least fairly soon, The Glass Castle opens this week. And I think we've talked about it earlier this summer as being in kind of the Help, the butler slot of like an early August sort of prestige movie play. And because I was on vacation, I think I missed like the embargo lifting or most discussion about it. So I don't know a ton about if it's any good. So maybe, Richard, you can talk me through it.
Yeah, I had high hopes for it just because... you know, I went in thinking that I wanted some kind of cathartic emotional release and I wanted to cry, basically. And
which is what the trailer definitely promises.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it does have its moments, but I found it a little bit lacking in in soul or something like that. I think that, you know, this is based on a huge best-selling memoir by Jeanette Walls, a former gossip writer for New York Magazine and other places, MSNBC, I believe. You know, and so this book was big and it was on bestseller list, I think, for years.
Yeah, it feels like everyone's mom read it at some point.
Yeah. And so it has this kind of weight of expectation. And I think that with these that kind of movie where the source material is so popular and so beloved, I think that there can be this peril in adapting it where you want to include all these bits from the book that people like or relate to or moves them. But what that results in, so this movie was, the screenplay was written by Andrew Lanham and Destin Daniel Cretton, who also directed, who also did Short Term 12.
Which was Brie Larson's big breakout movie. Exactly. And she's the star of this.
Exactly. You know, so in their adapting of it, I think that they just try to put too much in. And so it's this saga about a life that just feels too episodic and too sort of plotting, and there's not really an arc until the very end. And yeah, so it's kind of a shame, despite the fact that there are some really good performances in it.
Yeah, I feel like, I can't remember if we talked about this on the show or otherwise, but we talked about it maybe being Woody Harrelson's year. Like, he's got this kind of big, not I don't know about showy, but the kind of role that people win Oscars for, where it's like the troublesome dad who's in the supporting role. How does that pan out?
It's a big performance. It's a lot of performance, you know. I guess maybe I'm revealing some critical failing here, but like I had a hard time appreciating the performance because I hated the character so much. And I think you're kind of supposed to hate the character until you're not supposed to. It's a story about an abusive father, essentially. You know, he was this kind of nomadic alcoholic guy who dragged his family all over the American West and then back to his hometown in, I believe, West Virginia or Virginia, all the while, you know, sort of spouting off this kind of pseudo philosophy about living kind of off the grid or whatever, or not, you know, but at the core, I mean, this was an abusive situation, and he was abusive towards the mother, Rose, played by Naomi Watts. And so he's this really monstrous guy that in the end you kind of are supposed to feel this swell of sentiment for him, but I just didn't. And so I guess that means that Harrelson was good because he was convincing as this complete nightmare, but at the same time I couldn't really embrace it the way that maybe I'd wanted to. So, you know, it's another good sort of a big Harrelson performance, but whether it will really register given the kind of muted response to the movie and its odd placement in on the calendar, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it feels, it reminds me of Captain Fantastic in the way you described that. But that mm-hmm. movie feels like that character was a lot more sympathetic than what Woody Harrelson's doing here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the Captain Fantastic situation, like that's, you're sort of just, you don't like what he's doing, but you understand why he is in a way, where this is just this really selfish guy who pretends that he's not selfish and pretends that he's doing this all for his family when he's really just his own kind of weaknesses and failings are, you know, his primary motivators. And the movie is divided essentially into two timelines, one when Jeanette Walls' character is a kid and one when she's more grown up and played by Brie Larson. And in the grown-up section, which Brie Larson is very good in, I think, in a subtle way, there is some sort of, you know, coming to terms with this and reckoning with it that does, you know, put the blame on the dad in a way that feels just, but it tries to kind of get you to love him by the end in this way that I feel like, well, damn it, they let this abusive guy win, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that frustrated me.
So it's a weird year for Woody Harrelson. So he's had War for the Planet of the Apes out this year, which, you know, got great reviews, and I don't know that anyone ever talks about the humans in those movies. It's mostly the apes.
Yeah.
And he's got this and then three billboards outside Epping, Missouri, which is a Martin McDonagh movie. And then also his LBJ movie directed by Rob Reiner is coming out this fall, apparently.
Yeah.
After where he plays LBJ.
After premiering to very little notice at Toronto last year. So people have seen that one. Yeah, he's having a big year, and I don't know if that was an accident. He also had Wilson.
That was at Sundance, right?
Yeah, nothing has quite hit maybe the way that it could have. He's great in Apes. You know, I'm curious to see him in Three Billboards, which will be, I believe, at Venice and then at Toronto. That has potential. I mean, I really like Martin McDonagh's movies. He did Seven Psychopaths and In Bruges. It looks to be much more of a showcase for Frances McDormand, who's the lead, mm-hmm. but you never know. I mean, you know, there's always Woody sneaks in there with some supporting actor nominations here and there, right? So
yeah, he's had this kind of a surprising Oscar run where he gets nominated for movies that like aren't necessarily on everyone's. I mean, The Messenger, I think, is the you know, obviously People versus Larry Flint was a while ago at this point. I don't know. I feel like I'm rooting for him. Like the True Detective hype like bumped him up to such a place, and it feels like he like keeps capitalizing on it, and his moment's going to come. But I guess it's not The Glass Castle.
I don't think so. I mean, I can only speak for my own sort of reaction to it. But that said, like other reviews have not been that positive. So.
Yeah. Well, you also wanted to talk about another movie out this week that I don't think is as much of an obvious awards play, but Ingrid Goes West seems pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. That's a movie that was at Sundance and one I missed there, and I caught a screening of it. Actually, I watched it on a computer recently, and you know, not the best way to see a movie, but what can you do? So it's this movie directed by Matt Spicer, who has done a couple really small things, a couple shorts, but this is really his first big kind of, you know, feature. And it stars Elizabeth Olsen and Aubrey Plaza. Aubrey Plaza is this kind of sad sack girl, parents have died, and she becomes obsessed with this minor Instagram celebrity played by Elizabeth Olsen. So it's about sort of news, the problems of social media in a way that we're just starting to see reflected on film, which I think is kind of exciting because it's obviously a major part of people's lives now, and it hasn't quite gotten to the sort of fictional realm yet.
Yeah, it still feels like something that's like you write about on Twitter and don't like deal with in serious art.
Well, yeah, because I think that, you know, and this is a problem that's gone back to, I don't know, the net or whatever. It's hard to make compelling film or television about people sitting and staring at a screen, you know?
Yeah.
I think we're gradually figuring out how to make that interesting. Well, that, or it's just become more interesting to us because it's such a big part of our lives. And Ingrid Goes West, which is a dark, dark comedy, I think really taps into very, very observantly and very acutely into that particular kind of pang that you have, or some of us have, when we delve into Instagram and staring into someone's very polished and curated life and just wishing ourselves into it and wanting to be them or be their friend or date them. I mean, you know, we're in peak Fire Island season for me, and so I'm looking at those Instagrams and, you know, thinking twice about the whole wheat bagel I just ate, you know, so I can relate to it, and I think it's really sharp in that way. I think it goes a little over the top as it goes, but it's two great performances from Aubrey Plaza, who's had a good year with Legion and now this, but I think Elizabeth Olsen, who was just profiled by our own Josh Duboff on
the site. Great profile of her on VF.com,
and beautiful photographs by Justin Bishop. She's really good in this, in a subtle way, playing this person who you want to hate but also love. And she's not there's not some grand reveal that she's some queen bee bitch. She's a little bit mean sometimes, but she's mostly fine. And I think that playing that balance and instead of turning her into a villain, I think is a really smart bit of writing and of acting.
Because that feels like what happens when you meet someone whose Instagrams you admire is like you kind of want them to be like, aha, their life is terrible too. But for the most part, they're also just people who maybe are more genetically blessed than the rest of us.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that, you know, we have a tendency to both put these people on a pedestal and assume that everything's perfect. But then another part of our brain kicks in and says, well, but they're probably this. They're probably mean, or they're probably miserable, or they're probably dumb or whatever. And, you know, in my experience, I have met some of these Instagram people who I have longingly gazed at, you know, through my phone. And honestly, like a lot of times they've been like nice and kind of smart and kind of funny. And it's like, oh, I guess they're just lucky or luckier or whatever. But yeah, so the movie grapples with this stuff in ways that I find intriguing. And it's, you know, it's a small movie, but like I'm really eager to see what else comes out of this kind of line of thinking, you know, on film and in television. Like what are we going to do with all this new experience? And it's exciting to see writers and directors finally kind of starting to grapple with it, because there's a lot to be said about it. It's how so many people, younger people especially, spend their lives. So
what I like seeing it about being about adults, like I think you can make the story about teenagers, and yeah, I think there have been various attempts about like teens being seduced by social media,
of course, yeah.
But it happens to 30 somethings, which is, you know, I guess Elizabeth Olsen might be 30, but close enough.
Yeah, it happens at 30-somethings, and it also, you know, with it being adults, like, who have agency and can actually act on these things and act rashly, and, you know, I mean, as the title would suggest, Ingrid, played by Aubrey Plaza, moves. I mean, she goes west, and, you know, so it gives them, them being adults, they have a little more agency to do things, and which makes it kind of more creepy, I guess, you know, because a teenager sitting in their bedroom, in theory, can't really act on their Instagram obsession, or they can just gaze from afar. But when you're grown up and you have a little money, you know, you can do a little bit more.
Well, I look forward to you going to the Telluride Festival to find your favorite Instagrammer who lives out there and take some great shots of the mountains.
Katie, you weren't supposed to say that. That's really why I'm going.
I mean, you'll also see some movies, I assume, but you know, your cover is safe with me and the podcast listeners. So let's move on to your conversation with Carrie Coon, who is Emmy nominated for her role on Fargo, but also had a pretty stellar turn on The Leftovers, which just ended. I feel like we've talked about her on this podcast a lot because we're all a bunch of mega fans. And Joanna did a really fun interview with her earlier this year where she was like, I'm never getting Emmy nominated. It's not going to happen. And then, you know, we took the credit when she did. So I'm curious about what you guys talked about since you've been following her work pretty closely.
We kind of lead off with me just sort of asking her to go back and talk about the remarkable few years she's had. I mean, she was really, she was, as she says in the interview, a Midwest theater actress, not even a Chicago theater actress exactly, who got this role in a Steppenwolf production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Tracy Letts and Amy Morton that was in Chicago, then in D.C., and then on Broadway, and kind of took the world by storm. And she met and fell in love with Tracy Letts, so she got a husband out of the deal, but also got a Tony nomination. And then
it's like the best two-for-one deal of all time. Like, yeah. You got a career and a husband out of one role.
Yeah, seriously, where's that for me? So, you know, so that happened, and then it was kind of off to the races, and she got a role, a good, juicy supporting role in Gone Girl, and then The Leftovers, and now Fargo, and she's in Steven Spielberg's movie coming up, and she's having a really good run. So we talked about that and how that feels, and then we went into some more specifics about The Leftovers and Fargo, which I think we talked about how they're sort of a piece in terms of the political moment we're in and our feelings of despair. So she's great to talk to, really fun. I think it's a good interview. Well, I'm here today with Carrie Coon. Carrie, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I said to you off mic that we actually met once here in the elevator. Mm-hmm. I think you were here for something else, so I'm glad that we
did. Did we do anything embarrassing?
No, I just said, I think I said, I love you, I love The Leftovers, and then you were very nice, and then promptly we parted ways.
I'm glad I was nice and that I didn't leave you weeping in the elevator.
No. Though you have left me weeping recently with Leftovers and Fargo and just so many, you know, incredible moments on both those shows. So I want to talk about both of those, obviously, but I kind of want to start, if we can, by going back to when you sort of first entered the larger kind of public consciousness outside of Chicago theater with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yes.
Yeah. So you were Tony nominated for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that you did with your now husband, Tracy Letts, and Amy Morton. And who played?
Madison Dirks.
That's right.
That's
right. Yeah,
Madison
that's
Dirks.
Right. So that was your kind of first foray into like New York and New York theater and then bigger stuff. Did that feel kind of that monumental as it seems kind of from the past? I mean, from my perspective?
Changed everything in my life, utterly, yes. It was my first major role in Chicago. I had only done, that was my third play in Chicago.
Wow.
I had just come from doing a show at the Goodman. Anna Shapiro had just won the Tony for August Osage County. And then previously I'd done a show at a place called Remy Bumpo, which is a smaller theater. And then we had 18 months between our run in Chicago and our Broadway run, so I kind of did a couple of other plays in the storefront scene, but I really didn't come up in that city. I hadn't been much of a staple, like a lot of the actors I know are. So it was pretty shocking when it turned out, I mean, the producer came to our very last performance in D.C., so we very narrowly got this offer to come to Broadway, and then they had this idea of doing it on the 50th anniversary, so we had to wait. Which is terrifying because you're convinced you're going to forget the whole thing.
Right.
So we would get together and run the lines every couple of weeks. But anyhow, yes, we were in New York. We actually closed in March, well ahead of the Tonys, not thinking we'd be remembered at all. But I ended up staying in New York and taking meetings and doing all that. So I met with Ellen Lewis, a great casting director here, Chicagoan originally, and had a nice meeting. And then so around probably post-Tony Award time, I think sometime in June, they brought me in to read for The Leftovers, and I had read the book, so I knew the story, and I knew who Nora was, so they put me on tape. And about 10 days after that, I met with Damon Lindelof, and everybody said, now you're going to jump through some hoops and get studio approval, and you're going to test and all this stuff. But because Damon had such creative control, I just got an offer. And that was my first. I had done guest star spots, but I'd never done a series. So, and we didn't know if it was going to get picked up, so it was the pilot. And then about, a couple weeks later, I was back home in Chicago. And I did a taped audition in my living room for Gone Girl with this buddy of mine who taped it. He's since opened a taping business in Chicago. He tapes auditions using that story as his.
Well, it worked. I mean,
Works. It's good advertising. So, so then I ended up flying to LA for the first time, getting a GPS. They sent me on, I was driving all over that city taking meetings. I booked a guest star spot on a CBS show, Intelligence. And I met with David Fincher after a harrowing week of not being allowed to meet him because they didn't know if my HBO schedule would allow me to do the show. Sure. So they were keeping us apart. And then I went in and I read with David. We read the whole arc of Margot in a little room, and he read opposite me and gave me some adjustments. And then they said, well, you'll hear something in 10 days, but great job or what have you. And I was shooting that television show. Like 2 weeks later, I got the call that I booked Gone Girl. So then I went back to New York and shot the pilot of The Leftovers. And I'm only in one scene, so that was
right.
A 115 degree day, though we were.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, the Girl Scouts were dropping like flies. And then I went off almost immediately to Missouri to start shooting Gone Girl. So we were in Missouri for 6 weeks. Then we went to studio in L.A. So that was the most time I'd ever been in L.A. in my life. And then as soon as Gone Girl wrapped, I was starting season one of The Leftovers. It got picked up. So I actually shot that film before I did the rest of the show.
Right. And so when all this is happening, and it seemed to have happened pretty quickly, I mean, do you ever have a moment where you're able to sort of like put it in perspective, or you're just kind of like doing, you know, one thing after the next? And you know, or
it has felt awfully nonstop for the past 3 years, because of course then you know you're doing a TV show, and then Fargo comes along, and I jumped right onto Fargo. And so I feel that it's only now in my life where I'm looking back and saying, what an astonishing whirlwind that was. Yeah. I'm coming on 4 years of marriage. I cannot believe it was 4 years ago that Tracy and I got married, and, you know, having met 2 years prior to that. And it's pretty strange. And it feels like a cautionary tale. I just want to say to young actors, it doesn't normally go like this. Right. I hope it does.
Yeah.
For you.
I mean, it can, I guess, you know.
It absolutely can.
Do you feel like, I mean, this is maybe a trite question, but like, do you feel like it happened because you were ready for it, or like, did
I
you,
do believe yeah. in that. I, in some ways, I don't necessarily believe in luck. I believe in openness to opportunity. And sometimes when we think we know what the path looks like, our focus can be very narrow and we miss doors that are opening. And it's true that when Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf happened in Chicago, I had been in the Steppenwolf many times. I'd been called back many times, but I'd never booked anything. And that was the moment. I was ready to walk into that room and feel like I belonged there. And that's been true of just about every project. They have come at me when I was ready. I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah. So with The Leftovers, I mean, doing Gone Girl with David Fincher, that's kind of a no-brainer. Doing Virginia Woolf with, you know, that. But like, Leftovers was a little bit more of a sort of question mark because, you know, certain series don't always work in terms of adaptations of books or whatever. But did you have a certainty about that show or about Damon or?
I certainly felt an immediate kinship with Nora Durst, even when I read the book.
Yeah.
She's not actually as prominent in the book as you might think. And I wanted more of her when I read it. I'm a big fan of Tom Perata's, and I knew he was involved in the series. So that is great. I knew that Damon Lindelof had a storied history in the industry. You know, he was sort of the first celebrity showrunner because of Lost. Lost was not something I had watched from beginning to end. I caught the end, which meant I could predict everything that was going to happen because I didn't have all the history under me.
Right.
But so I knew that in terms of the television world, he was a big deal. And it was HBO. And I'd always respected the material HBO had put out. But I didn't have any intention of going into TV and film specifically. I had done commercials in Chicago. I had done guest star spots in Chicago, but I was making my living as a theater actor in the Midwest. I was fine doing that. And so I actually didn't really have enough time to be scared. I didn't have enough time to know the water I was swimming in, which is a wonderful way to move through your life, just sort of joyfully and ignorantly. It's kind of lovely.
Yeah.
So of course I said yes. And it was my first TV job. You have to start somewhere.
What was the biggest, like, I don't know, the biggest learning curve, or like the you know, I mean, you sometimes hear about actors who've never done television or film saying, mm-hmm. I didn't know how to hit my mark or what that even was. Right. Or was there anything like that for you?
Well, I knew sort of rudimentary vocabulary, but when I went to Gone Girl, David's vocabulary is very sophisticated, as well as Ben Affleck's and Kim Dickens and all these people that have been doing this for, you know, over 20 years. And so I remember my first day of scene work. We started doing exteriors down in Missouri, so that was easy. That's getting in and out of SUVs and getting to know your, you know, Tyler Perry and Ben Affleck. But my first scene day, David kept saying, I'm not getting enough screen direction. And he was instructing me to lift my head at this particular angle and then pick up a magazine and do it in a very specific order. And I was confused about the order, and I didn't know what he meant, what he needed. And eventually from Video Village, I heard him go, you can't do it. And he was frustrated. And Ben was really sweet. He's like, don't worry about it. No big deal. Tomorrow's a new day. He was very lovely. But I was terrified I was going to get fired because people get fired. Mm-hmm. And we were very early in the process. But I got to talk to David and I said, you've hired somebody that doesn't know this stuff and you need to help me a little bit because when I know what you need, I promise you, I can give it to you. And the thing about David is that he's a perfectionist and so am I. So we, after that, we got along so well because he would show me what he needed. He would say, Carrie, come look at the monitor. See this shot? I need you to glide out on your right foot. You can't move. Whatever it was that he required of me, he would show me. So I got to go to this kind of incredible acting film school with David Fincher.
Yeah.
And we had a ball. He's really fun. He was particularly relaxed, I'm told, by his wife, Sian, who's also his producer in that film. And so he's very funny. He's got a very dry sense of humor, yeah. which I share.
I mean, you do hear these stories about like we did 70 takes or whatever.
Yeah, and that's true.
Yeah. But,
that's absolutely true.
But there's a laborious way to do that, I guess. Like it can still be fun and interesting.
I was desperate for as many takes as I could get because I'd never done it before and I wanted it to be good. The thing about David when you're doing 70 takes is you know he's not going to quit till he gets what he needs. Mm-hmm. So you can leave the day fairly confident that you've gotten everything he needed of you. Which is actually kind of reassuring in a way.
It eliminates all that kind of second guessing.
Yes, because it's like we did everything we could possibly do with that line.
Yeah.
And every now and then you'd get something in 5 takes or 7 takes and then you feel really good about yourself and everybody makes fun of you and, you know.
So you did that and then you went into like the full series of The Leftovers. Mm-hmm. And at that point you felt like pretty confident in the medium and
No. Well, the challenge, so when you're working on a film as a supporting part, there's a lot of time when you're in a scene, but you're not saying anything and movies are very slow. So when I showed up for my first day of real scene work on The Leftovers, it was the scene with Chris Eccleston in episode two, it must be, when we had the argument in the kitchen. And we did one part of the scene and we did it 3 times. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, this is feeling pretty good. Okay, here we go. And they're like, okay, great, moving on. I was like, whoa. Yeah. Hey, I was just getting warmed up over here. Like, what are we doing? So it was then I had to adjust myself to the pace of television, which is totally different than a film, especially a Fincher film that you shoot for 100 days. So that was a rude awakening. And then the emotional requirements of The Leftovers were also quite different. I had one emotional scene in Gone Girl, but nothing like what I was asked to do in The Leftovers. Yeah. And, you know, repeating a catharsis is not simple.
No.
But its very nature is a release. So to stuff it back in and do it again is completely unnatural. And in the theater, you do it once a night.
Right. And then you can
have a story to build up to it. And then you come down. TV and film, it's like it's 2 a.m. It's time to do your crying climax. Get out here.
So how do you get there? I mean, or do you have to kind of like recalibrate Nora's reaction to something because you can only get so far?
No, hopefully you're able to deliver the thing that's required of you every time. I think that's your job. So hopefully I was able to do that as fully as possible. But yeah, you have to figure out what that means for you. So for me, it meant carrying around this book called Wave and reading it on set when I needed to. It was a story of a woman who lost her family in the tsunami.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it became my touchstone for that part because I had not experienced grief of that degree, thankfully. And then knowing how to focus yourself on set, even when other things are going on. And fortunately for me, I was working in very professional places. So when I had to do the Holy Wayne scene, everybody on set is completely focused on that moment with me so that I can stay in between and just sit in a chair and wait for them to be ready and then get up and do it again. And everybody is sort of willing you to do it well.
Yeah.
On a good set. And I always have worked on, you know, really professional sets with amazing camera people and support, and it's been great.
Well, it shows in the work, I feel like, you know. So with something like Leftovers and Nora and the way that show and the characters kind of constructed, you don't really know necessarily where anything's headed. And I think one of the great things about that show was that they leave a lot of question marks still kind of lingering at the very end. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges of playing that kind of unknown?
I really came to enjoy it because when you do theater, you obviously know how the play ends. So I always thought it was funny that a writer or it would keep material from a television actor, or a television actor would say, no, I don't want to know that. So I can, I'm like, well, we know that stuff all the time. We still do it. That's right. What your imagination's for. But it was really fun to realize that you were going to get your script 2 days before you had to shoot it. You had no control over what was going to happen and you couldn't possibly guess what Damon was going to throw at you. But what's exciting about working with somebody like Damon, which is different from what's exciting about working with Noah Hawley or David Fincher, is that Damon is pursuing things in his actors that interest him. So inevitably what happens is that you're on a very personal journey because he's putting you up against yourself over and over again. Your weaknesses, your fears. You know, how many times did he drown Justin Theroux or make him sing karaoke? Right. It's like he sniffs out what we're terrified of, our own annihilation, basically, and then makes us confront it over and over again. And I'll miss that. I'll miss not knowing what's coming to me.
Yeah.
I'm sure there'll be another project that's similar, but this was such a wild and brave world we were playing in, and it didn't adhere to any of the rules, and I loved it.
It didn't adhere to also kind of the rules sometimes of how television is received. I feel like because that first season, it had its fair share of fans, but the critical kind of consensus hadn't really congealed around the show until season two. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you guys were paying attention to at all? I mean, obviously you want to get good ratings or whatever, but sure.
Well, yeah, what you're really wondering about is what does my life look like?
Right.
And our pickups were so late. You're really beholden to that contract, so you can't put yourself out there for other work. So as an actor, out of self-interest, you're always monitoring what's going to happen with the show you're on. And of course, you want it to continue. And there was a lot of uncertainty. There was some question of them picking up the whole show, moving it to a new town with a new cast, and showing another town's experience.
Mm-hmm.
So none of us knew if we were going to be returning. And none of us knew where we were going to shoot when we did. So there was there were a lot of question marks. And as an actor, though, you're kind of accustomed to living that way. There's a lot of uncertainty. We have very little control over our circumstances. The only power we have is no. And even that you don't get for a long time. You just have to say yes all the time. So, yeah, I guess I was hopeful that it was going to be received well. I also knew, though, that our first season was pretty humorless. And I know that anybody who's dealt with a tragedy, anybody who's a human being knows that humor is such a critical part of being a person in the world.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a sense of humor, it actually feels inauthentic. So I think the real shift we made in season two, besides adding some really extraordinary cast members in Regina King and Kevin Carroll and Jasmine and Giovanna Depo, particularly, was that we recovered a sense of humor. And it just got funnier and weirder as it went on. And I think that really made it feel actually more tethered to the real world.
Were there any moments where you were like, oh, okay, this is too weird? I mean, I think season three, the way that it's set up, you're just like, what the heck is going on?
I mean, by then you just have given up everything. Certainly the first time I read, well, I can tell you that in season one, when they had the scene where Nora had a gun in her purse.
Right, yeah.
I remember going and saying, guys, so exciting. What is this for, this gun? And they were like, we don't know. I was like, what? Yeah, we don't know. I was like, okay, great. So when that scene came up and what it was for was having a prostitute shoot me in the chest, I was like, I'm not sure the people are going to go with us on this one, but I'll sell it as hard as I can. And that was the first thing we shot on that episode, which was the most I'd ever shot on TV in my life, that 10 days.
Yeah, it's quite an introduction to a character's kind of inner life.
Certainly.
Yeah, you know.
It was great.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a special show, and I think that it means a lot, or a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. You know, and I want to ask you about that ending, you know, spoiler alert, but before that, like, what does the show kind of mean for you? Like, if you were seeing it as an audience member, what would you take out of it, do you think? Or maybe hard to answer because you were on it, but
I remember when season one aired and some of the criticism that was leveled at the show was about how it felt hopeless. And to me, what it actually was, much like Tom's book, was a testament to how human beings will strive to continue to find meaning in a world that is maybe very apparently meaningless. And we're just built that way. And that examination is, you know, that's the preoccupation of philosophy going back to the foundations of civilization. What are we doing here? What is our purpose? And that's the question the show was always asking for me, which is a question I ask in my life. So for me, I was always interested in the investigation. And also, the thing about Damon is that he's not a cynical guy. And so I knew that it kept coming back to love. It kept being tethered to love. And I think we ended that way, most certainly. So for me, the show always felt like a testament to resilience, to the ability of human beings. My dad always used to say when I was little, he would say, life will out. That wherever there is any kind of destruction, something will emerge. And that's a pretty astonishing revelation if you're willing to embrace it. And so for me, that always felt like a very large idea we were dancing with. And I was grateful to be making art on TV where things can be very disposable, that felt like it was asking some real questions.
Yeah. Speaking of questions,
Fans of the show, viewers of the show will know what I mean when I ask. Do you think at the end, do you think that Nora is telling the truth?
I'll never tell.
Yeah.
Because it robs a viewer of their own experience.
Yeah.
And what I think doesn't matter. I'm just an actor on a show.
Yeah.
And though I am Nora Durst, the reality is that the performance wouldn't change. If whatever I have decided, the performance would actually be the same, because the goal is the same. It's to convince Kevin, whether it's real or not. So it's so interesting what a burning question that is for people.
Yeah.
But the fun of it is, what does it say about you? You know, what did you think?
I'm the credulous type. I was like, I think she went and it really happened and she saw her family and knew that it, you know, so I believe it.
And
you know?
And that says so much about who you are in the world and how you perceive the world. When we were on set, it was about a 50-50 split with the crew. Most of our screenings have been about 70-30 with people believing her.
Interesting.
And Damon was really struck by that. He thought there would be more skepticism about the story, but Damon and I never talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, I was genuinely surprised. I think the next morning when I was like looking at recaps, I was like, wait, people thought she was lying?
Obviously she was lying. It's fascinating.
Yeah. It's an interesting kind of Rorschach test, I guess.
It really is.
Yeah. So your other kind of big TV project this year, Fargo, which you're Emmy nominated for. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's really exciting. You're going to the show, I assume. And,
you know. I mean, I don't know why I should bother.
It's quite a category.
It's just so, I keep saying I'm going to just get some silky pajamas and watch it in my bed because it's just, I can't believe I'm included.
Well, hey, it's great. I mean, it's so that the show might seem at first kind of, I guess, tonally different than The Leftovers, but I think that both shows are about kind of existential questions, particularly your season of Fargo. I think with your squaring off against David Thewlis' character, there's a lot of stuff that relates to current political catastrophes about if you can confront these kind of massive systems that seem sort of rigged against us. And, you know, is there any point in fighting against this kind of thing? Was that sort of political tenor like on your minds when you were making it, or like what?
There's no room I've been in since November where we haven't talked about politics in about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's sort of inevitable right now, at least where we're living. You know, I'm not fighting for my basic survival, and therefore every 5 minutes I'm talking about politics. I realize the privilege of the position I'm in to worry about the things I get to worry about. But that's what artists are supposed to do. Damon Lindelof and Noah Hawley are filtering the world that they are living in through their own creative genius, and they're making something out of that that helps them understand or helps them live in the world. And so Fargo is always ridden on this trope of, is this a true story? And this thing about alternative facts waltzes into the world, and it just makes perfect sense that it would fit into Fargo the way that it does. This idea that reality is now in question, and that without facts you can't make a rational argument. And if you can't make a rational argument, how can you reason through and make a law? And how can you convince people that they should follow it? And like you say, how futile is this fight against systems that seem oppressive? And do we have a responsibility to fight that fight, or do we just try to get what we can get out of it and exploit other people because it's the survival of the fittest, right? These are really important questions. They're questions. We're in a real crisis moment, I think. My husband's fond of saying, as all these commentators on TV say, we have to decide what kind of country we want to be. He always says, we decided. We already decided. Which is a pretty dark perspective, and he kind of, you know, he has some brighter days. I don't think he'd still be writing plays if he really believed that he didn't feel he had a responsibility in the world. But it is unnerving, especially as we're, you know, burying ourselves in plastic and maybe being distracted from the actual existential things that might really kill us.
Mm-hmm.
So I really respect the way Noah took the world we were living in and was an alembic for it, and it's a way that we can examine our circumstances from a safe distance. And that's what entertainment, quote unquote, is for. It's what the Greeks and the Romans used theater for. It was to say, here's a moral question, and now you have to take a stand. And that's why I think the ending, again, an ending I won't, we didn't talk about, so I don't know what happens really. But it's interesting because the first draft of it was much more weighted toward Varga.
Mm-hmm.
Gloria spoke much less and didn't have that sort of more powerful speech about really what it is to live in America. And so they rebalanced it a little bit, and then it became more of a 50-50 question, which I'm glad they did, just because I think it's really because it's what we needed. I think the world was feeling too tenuous. And had they put the more cynical version of that out there, I think it would have been hard for people to take.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that makes Fargo this year particularly active and relevant in its investigation. And I feel really privileged to be a part of this season in particular because, you know, it was therapeutic for all of us to be working on something that at least it was engaged with characters who were trying to confront that system or participating in that system so we could ask ourselves those questions.
Yeah, and I think it's really fortunate that people are able, some people, lucky people, are able to work through these kind of mm-hmm. things at work, you know?
Yes.
But do you have anything outside of work that you, like, I know I go to HGTV and I watch, like, real estate shows or whatever. Do you have anything like that in your life?
I mean, I love to be outside. I'm a person who can't stay indoors all day. My husband can stay inside for 10 days in a row.
Well, he's a writer. So, I mean, that's
kind of
right.
Yeah, I guess that's what they do. Yeah. Masochistic, maybe. So I like to get outside and take a walk. I'm a big reader. So one of the things I had to do was stop looking at the news at night. I read every night before bed. So I always try to find, lately, having a good book to read has been super critical because it gives me a place to go when things feel a little unmanageable.
Like something fiction or?
Yeah. I mean, it varies. For example, I just finished doing The Papers with Steven Spielberg. So while that was going on, I was reading Katharine Graham's wonderful biography called Personal History. And so sometimes I like to read in a way that's relevant to the thing I'm working on just to keep my head space in the right arena. It can be really hard to read fiction when you're memorizing lines or so sometimes I tend toward nonfiction when I'm working. But lately, yeah, I've really needed an escape at night. So I do that a lot. And, you know, all the usual things, exercise. Yeah. My husband and I love to cook. Inevitably, mm-hmm. if we're together, we're cooking 6 nights a week if we can. And also getting ready for a play has been a nice distraction
yeah.
for me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that and about this, you know, you very casually dropped a Steven Spielberg reference.
I know, I've become a terrible yeah. name dropper yeah. since
no,
a well, few
hey,
months
you
ago.
Know, what can you do?
Everybody's in it.
So what was that experience like? I mean, Spielberg, that's a big deal. I mean,
it's a very big deal. It's interesting because within the same month, I worked with both Steve McQueen and Steven Spielberg.
Oh my God, that's right. You're doing
yeah,
the McQueen
Widows
movie.
As yeah. well. Now, I wow. just did a few days on Widows. It was a pretty quick work. But the caliber of actors I'm coming up against is pretty astonishing. You know, I was in scenes with Viola Davis and a little bit with Liam Neeson. And then moving over into the Spielberg movie, it's Meryl and it's Tom Hanks. But then it's this incredible cast of characters from TV and film in 2017.
The IMDb just cast list is insane.
It's so ridiculous. So I've been awfully spoiled this year. But it was great. Steven Spielberg is a lovely, generous man who loves what he's doing. And Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep have been making movies for decades and they love doing it. And that's really infectious.
Yeah. That's going to be out like later this year, right? Mm-hmm. And so is there any, and with the Emmys coming up, we are ostensibly a podcast about sort of award season and stuff like that. I have to ask, like, is that stuff that you pay attention to? I mean, do you like see a movie that you could be in like the Spielberg movie and say, oh, that's an Oscar movie?
Unfortunately, I don't have the luxury of having that conversation with myself right. because I still have to fight for every job I get. I mean, that's not entirely true. I was offered Fargo because Noah knew my work and was able to talk to Damon and the, you know, studio approved of me or what have you. But in terms of film work, I wish I could say this is the role I'm going to do that's going to be nominated.
Right.
But the truth is it's a real dog eat dog world out there and about 12 people have to die before I'm top of that list. So that's not going to happen. I guess the deeper into the business I get, the more I'm conscious of those things.
Yeah.
Like that this movie's being placed for Oscar consideration means it comes out in November, December or what have you. But I can't say that I'm totally savvy about all that stuff.
Are you a viewer of those things? Do you have like
a... I never see as many movies as I should. Yeah. I'm always behind. You know, the Oscars roll around and inevitably I haven't seen any of them and I have to sort of rush to catch up and I also like to see movies with my husband. I don't tend to see movies when he's not around. He's a big movie buff, so he's kind of my movie guide. I always, if I'm working on location, he'll come visit, and it becomes very apparent that I haven't even turned on the television. I don't know how. I haven't watched anything, so I'm always a little behind the eight ball.
Well, now you're putting screen stuff aside and doing a play, mm-hmm. kind of your first, you know, your first love, if you want to call it that. Can you talk to us about this play? Like, is that sure. New York Theater Workshop and mm-hmm. what it is? And
it's Amy Herzog's new play.
Oh, she's great.
She's really yeah. great. And it premiered at Yale Rep earlier this year. This is the New York premiere at New York Theater Workshop. It's a great cast, all women. I think five of us, if I'm correct. none of whom I've worked before, but several of whom I've known their work for a long time. And it's a play that I did a reading of very early when Amy was writing it, a very early reading. So we had a very personal connection. I had a very personal connection to it. So the fact that it came around in the calendar in such a way that I could do it was really, we were all very surprised that I was available to do this run. Much to the chagrin of my publicists who are trying to get me an Emmy. So it's about a woman, a single mother, who has a child with a very severe degenerative disorder, congenital disorder, a child that's never been able to eat or breathe on his own. And she has these nurses who are coming and going, these people that she wouldn't ordinarily encounter unless she'd been living this particular life with her son. And so it's these conversations with these women basically coming in and out in her apartment and then in the PICU, which is the, you know, infant emergency ward, basically. And Amy Herzog has a child with a very severe disorder and lives this life, though she's partnered. She has Sam Gold, who's helpful, of course. I mean, it's their child. But I believe that the play actually is about Amy's spirituality. Because if you hear it's a play about a single mom of a sick kid, you think, oh, that's going to be heavy. But this woman is quite naturally sort of easy and light. And that's not something I get asked to do very often, though it's much closer to my personality than the things that I play. I hope.
Right. Yeah, no.
She's lugubrious. And
guys, she's been crying this whole time. You can't tell.
So it's actually really nice for me to go do something that actually sits a little closer to who I actually am. These other things are much further from me than this character. And it's not maudlin. There's not a lot of crying. It's really a spiritual piece, and it's an unusual structure, and it's good for me to get back in a room like that and have to do the work of that deeper investigation into a scene. Because in TV and film, you get 12 tries and you're done, and then you forget it. It's very different to keep discovering something for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it just puts me back in touch with my own taste.
Will this be your first play since Virginia?
No. I've been back on stage just about every 2 years.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
I did a small play called Placebo at Playwrights Horizons about 2 years ago. And I did my husband's play at the beginning of season 3 this year. I was in Chicago commuting between Austin and Chicago doing Tracy's play Mary Page Marlowe, which is actually coming to New York. Not our production. There's a new production being put up at Second Stage this season.
I think I read a review.
For this summer.
That sounded really good.
Yeah. It's really,
I saw August 3 times on Broadway. Once with Felicia Rashad, which was incredible.
That was a fun time. I mean, they had great replacements all throughout the run, but I never saw it. I've never seen it.
You never saw August Lois Chowney? Wow.
I was doing Shakespeare in Wisconsin when it was taking the world by storm, and I thought Tracy Letts was a girl. I didn't know anything about it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Well, maybe they'll do it again someday. You can
I think,
see it.
Well, they're coming up on their 10th anniversary.
That's crazy.
So there's going to be a 10-year anniversary production, inevitably. So I'll see it.
Yeah, good. You should. It's a good play.
Yeah, thanks.
So you've done Spielberg, you've done television, you're doing theater. Is there anything, what do you want to do next? Like, is there a role you want to tackle?
I want to do a comedy. I would. That's kind of a joke, but it's kind of not a joke. My family really can't understand why I'm doing all this serious work. They don't think of me as a particularly serious person. They think of me as a very clumsy, messy person. But that's something I'd like to do that would be different. I want to do something I haven't done before.
Do you sing?
Not formally.
Okay.
I can't walk and sing at the same time like those actually talented people. But I grew up playing guitar with my dad. We all sort of sing a little bit with guitar. And so something like that would be fun to do. I don't want to play a grieving cop mom, which is what inevitably comes to you after you play those parts
on
TV.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And is there any way that, like, are you just kind of like seeing what comes next, or can you be active in that process, or like?
Yeah, I think as any woman in this business who's starting to get a little older has to turn an eye to producing. Otherwise, you're not going to get asked to do anything. We've seen it with Reese Witherspoon with her amazing production company, all the properties she's purchased, Big Little Lies. You know, she's really helmed a lot of those female centric projects. And a lot of women are going in that direction.
Gone Girl included.
Yeah, Gone Girl included. Frances McDormand, I think, was largely a big part of getting Olive Kittredge produced. So I suspect that what's going to happen is I'll be looking for things I'm interested in doing. That requires more activity on my part and some free time. So that's probably what will happen. But it's funny when people ask me what I want to play next, I just think, well, I haven't read it yet.
Right.
You know, I'll know it when I read it. But it will be something I haven't done.
And would you, you know, sign that 7-season contract for a show right now? Or are you kind of like in this more, the shorter run things? I mean,
I do really like the limited series. Yeah. There's something about not being stuck and knowing that if you start to fall into your bag of tricks, it's going to be over soon.
Right.
Because, you know, some of that stuff's not really sustainable. The writing would have to be so good to sustain a premise for more than 5 years. And I was offered a couple of those projects, a handful of projects, right after Fargo finished, and I wasn't ready to commit 5 or 8 years of my life, especially right now when I was sort of, it's kind of a peak moment for me. And I want to be very, very particular about what I do next. And I also don't have to do anything. So I get to be patient and wait. That's the luxury of having some modicum of success, is that you get to wait.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting.
Well, we can't wait to see what you do next, whatever it is. And, you know, break a leg on stage.
Come see it.
Yeah, I'm going to. Yeah. All right.
Mary Jane, New York Theater Workshop.
When does it run through?
We start previews in September.
Okay.
I don't have a date. I'm the worst.
Well, we could figure it out.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carrie. This is great.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this week's episode of Little Gold Men. I'm closing out the episode instead of Katie because her power went out in North Carolina. So we're just now, it's just me here alone talking to you. anyway, you can follow us at Little Gold Men. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, please. It really helps us get new listeners into, you know, just getting feedback is important for us. You can follow me at Rylaws, Katie Rich at Katie Rich, Joanna at Joe Wrote This, Mike at Mike _ Hogan. This episode was produced by Jennifer Lyon, edited by Jordan Bell. Thanks as ever to Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the best way to cope with summer Instagram goes to Katie Rich.
Aha! Their life is terrible too.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.